Okay, so Dr. Savika, how are you?
Doing fine. Good to see you.
Great.
Pleasure
It's
to be
really good to
here.
see you too. I'm excited to talk about living well with young onset Parkinson's disease. So let's just jump right into it. First of all, can you just tell everybody a little bit about who you are
Sure.
and how you got involved in this work?
Sure. My name is Rodolfo Savica. I'm one of the consultants at the Mayo Clinic, professor of neurology. And I dedicated my last 20 years of my, well, I mean, over 20 years now of my life working with Parkinson's disease. Especially in the last decade or so, I devoted myself specifically to people that have Parkinson's disease, but they are younger. And I am spending time running a full clinic on people with people that have early onset Parkinson's disease. It's one of the few clinics that we have in North America devoted to Parkinson's disease affecting a younger population, as well as I'm having my own research lab, and we are working on a number of initiatives and projects to try to understand, try to advance the knowledge on Parkinson's disease, especially affecting a younger population, and ultimately to cure or at least to delay as much as possible the disease, and to ultimately help our patient population, making sure that everybody's having a full life. To be honest, I hope that one day I will be able to retire and my help wouldn't be needed. This means that we accomplish at least the goal of helping people with this condition.
Right. That is a great goal. Let's keep that one going. Okay. So there's been a lot of talk. There was a paper that came out called Age Cutoff for Early Onset Parkinson's Disease: Recommendations from the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society Task Force on Early Onset Parkinson's Disease. It came out and it is talking about people diagnosed before the age of 50. And what there was a blurb in the paper that I just want to read in case, people haven't seen it yet, and I'll share it in the notes, but it said authors who have first developed an interest in and published on this subgroup of PD have preferred the use of YOPD. However, there has been a shift toward the use of EOPD in the past two decades. There are no clear publications detailing the rationale behind this shift, but it seems motivated by an attempt to avoid age-related stigmatization. Oh my gosh. Thus, the recommendation of the Early Onset Parkinson's Disease Task Force of the MDS is to use the term EOPD to designate PD with an onset of motor symptoms before the specific age that was agreed on. Now, the biggest concern I hear about the conclusion that this paper came to is that nobody living with Parkinson's was part of the task force. So, first of all, is that true? And then, second of all, if it is true, how did the decision not to involve that community get made? And how was it determined that using the term young was actually a negative age-related term?
So, first of all, I'm guilty of the paper. I am the chair of the task force, okay? And I want to clarify one point for many people. So, this task force is part of the Movement Disorder Society. This particular task force and this society is a scientific society. So, it's based upon a group of people, researchers, people from all over the world, the globe. It's a global organization that has only scientific purpose, doesn't have any purpose of legislation, doesn't have a purpose in the goal of the society to have a patient-centered care. This is scientific, based upon the idea of advancing science, not necessarily changing any legislation of all over the world. It's true, the experts on the field that participate in task force are all physicians and PhDs of the entire globe. They were a representation of people from Africa, from Iran, from China, from Asia in general, not just China, from Australia, from Europe, from North and South America. And this task force has been working avidly in the last 2.5 years, ever since the inception, to try to harmonize. So the goal of this manuscript is to harmonize and try to help having, number one, a clear cutoff for the age, because at least we know what we're talking about. And current cutoff is about 50 and below. When 50, 55, there's some kind of grace time, we can think about it. Why we say that? Because according to the different countries, in some countries, early onset Parkinson, young onset Parkinson is considered below the age of 65 because of the need of the national system. In some other countries, it's 40 and below. But why this is important? Because when we are putting together data, when we are trying to understand what we are talking about, if there are five different age cutoffs, it's impossible to know what we are talking and what are their actual number. Because it's true, early onset Parkinson's disease, young onset Parkinson's disease is on the rise. But if, as you can imagine, if we change cutoff for the age of onset, we can have different chunks of result. So the goal of this manuscript was to address the age, not too much the name to start with. Second thing I want to say about the name, the idea of using early onset is because it's working very well also against the opposite. So early versus late onset works very well. Young was the opposite of young. Old. you know what I mean? And this is English. This is a global organization. So in some languages, and I tell you, for example, I speak few of them, but I'm Italian, in Spanish, it doesn't work. Young wouldn't work. If you translate young in Italian, it's not gonna work. It simply doesn't sound right and can increase the confusion. The way I see it is that we can use scientifically the word early onset, so at least we know what we're talking about. We know we are talking about this particular beast. But I think we can keep both. I have no problems in keeping young versus early. I don't have any emotional attachment toward one or the other. I think they're both equally relevant, and they're both having good reason why one is this, one versus the other. One thing that we are taking advantage now after this manuscript is that we would like to make sure that the patients now are involved in a conversation. The task force is of the NDS is moving to a study group, which is a different kind of nature that can be more inclusive. It can allow people to participate. We have an organization that reach out to me from the UK that are working in trying to give a response, a scientific response on why young is more important. And I think many patients can do the same. I think we have to keep both terms, but we should all agree that we know what we're talking about, whether it's early or whether it's young. As long as we talk about it, that's to me very important. And again, I have no emotional component. As you can see, I go back and forth between early and young. It doesn't change too much to me, as long as we know what we're talking about here.
Yeah. So it sounds, I mean, what I'm hearing, it sounds like for sort of research and clinical reasons, having the term that is global, people do research from multiple countries together, right? And so if you're talking about saying it one way and someone else is saying it another way, right? It's like that's a challenge. And so clinically, research using early onset, having that nomenclature that's common is important and great.
Very important. Also, because I want to tell you, up to now, 2021, 2022, there was not such initiatives everywhere in the world. So the Movement as Early Society took the problem, faced the problem, say, okay, we have an issue, we had to fix it. In the past, we didn't have this, even this conversation. And as you can know, in the literature, people were talking about young, juvenile, juvenile for a while or early. And it was a lot of confusion. And it was this condition, Parkinson's disease affecting the young, was considered a rare disease affecting a small amount of population that has some familiar genetic problem. And it's not true. So we have to do a lot of steps. And to be honest, and that's why I'm here, but you know that, you know myself, you know the way I think, but everybody knows the way you think. We need to partner up together in the right steps at the right time to lobby about the problem, to think about the problems, to raise awareness. But first of all, we have to understand what we're talking about globally.
Yeah.
Globally. Yeah. Because we are using English, clearly, as the main language, and we should, because it's the scientific language. But it's not working, again, seems to be silly, but it's not working everywhere the same.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a problem. It's a problem because we had to raise awareness in entire continents where there's not too much access to information. North America, UK, all the even Australia, so all the English-speaking countries and continents are taking the lead in this initiative. And these debates are fantastic about young, early, or whatever, but we had to think about beyond that.
Yeah.
Because if you think globally, it's more meaningful to me understanding, giving an idea, and not a fixed, strict cutoff but of age, but an idea about what we're talking about, knowing that we're dealing something different than Parkinson's disease affecting later ages, that would be already the biggest message. Then we can call it young, early, whatever. It doesn't matter to me. Again, because I don't have an emotional component attached to that. We base upon this decision of calling early just because of the available literature. What was there was not based upon a decision made, I don't know where, by some big wigs in their offices. No, it was about what was already published in the literature.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, that makes sense. And I'm really appreciative of, you know, talking through that, because I know a lot of people in our community feel very strongly about keeping that term. And I think part of it is, you know, this, I know, you know, from my experience in the US and the UK, that is, I mean, a little bit in Australia, but it's just like sort of a cultural, they feel like they can belong to a YOPD community versus an early onset community. So I think that's absolutely part of it, right? And it's different for people who are, I think that there might be a case, right, for keeping both the terms in play, one for clinicians, researchers, and one for those living with it, if they so choose to use that, if that
as term, long as we know what we're talking about.
Right. So right. Part of that is we're going to define that. So in some ways, right. So like you've said before that YOPD and late onset, or early onset and late onset, are two really different diseases. And correct. Based on, you know, sort of where you landed with the age, how were you able to get everyone to agree? And what were some of the different things that people are bringing to the table when somebody said, well, we call it, it's 65 years old because that's the retirement age. Well, we brought them down to 50. Like, how did those conversations go? Yeah, how do they make sense? Right. Cause I think in my head, I'm like, so if it's truly a different disease, does it truly a different disease if I'm 54 and I'm 50? Like, how does this work?
So let me tell you, number one, that was not an easy process. So talking about years, seriously, of multiple meetings where, I remember the first meeting I said, oh my God, what I've been through now. I don't know what to do, because my role is to mediate the different, being the chair of the task force is to mediate the different souls of the problem and try to come with an organic plan. And it was tough. It was tough because you know, people coming from different backgrounds, different countries, a different way of calling, coding, identifying, and reimbursing the diseases according mm-hmm. to the system. But I would say all my colleagues were quite reasonable about it. We tried to identify, and that's what we did, the biologically underlying reason why 50 would make sense. There's a hormonal reason, there's a number of papers previously published on this particular different cutoff of age, noticing on how things switch around 50 to 55. And I agree with you, this is an artifact. Using 50 is an artifact, because if I am having Parkinson's disease and I have been diagnosed and my symptoms started at 51, would I be not considered early onset? No, I think biologically, people need to be considered early onset, despite they are 1 year above this cutoff. We had to try not to be dogmatic, especially in this particular cutoff, and saying before or after, because it's not working this way. This is not what medicine, modern medicine, is about. For sure, we know that somebody's young, and to me, somebody's young as long as, even the concept of young, we talked this in the task force, is really different according to different culture. I remember this was raised by a colleague from Japan. I said, a young in my country is something different than yours. And I say, you're right. That's why early would be working scientifically a bit more better in your case, but it doesn't really matter. To me and to us, what is early onset Parkinson? Why is it different? What are the differences of early onset Parkinson compared to people that are older in age? Whether it's 50, whether it's 55, whether it's 47, are there differences? Yes. And this goes to the concept that is currently developed by a number of colleagues, that there are no two Parkinson disease that look alike. Clearly, we can try to lump together things, especially as we get a little bit older, assuming that there is the disease is caused by an accumulation of a number of proteins, the famous Lewy bodies, the famous alpha-synuclein. And it's true, as we get older, this is more likely the cause of the problem. The common outcome is that accumulation of alpha-synuclein. And the reason why it's accumulating comes from different sources. But when we are younger, this is not necessarily a common outcome. The common outcome is a damage, a dysfunction, whether it's temporary, whether it's permanent, of the dopamine activity in the brain. The vast majority is contained in the basal ganglia, but there are other areas of the brain that contain dopamine. So it's not necessarily just in basal ganglia. So the common theme of Parkinson's disease is that dopamine activity doesn't work very much. Earlier onset Parkinson's disease, the more we get close to our teenager eras, is likely that we are dealing with a different disease that is not due to accumulation of alpha-synuclein, is not due to accumulation of aging proteins that are present as we get older, because clearly my brain, when I'm in my 30s, is not the same brain when I'm in my 60s or 70s or 80s. Aging is taken and removed out of the equation, which is a major driving force for degeneration. So in earlier onset Parkinson's disease, 50, 51, 52, 55, even 57, depends on what we see. What we need to be looking at is what are the underlying reasons why this process of dopaminergic dysfunction is happening. And it can be metabolic, can be autoimmune, can be after infection, can be inflammatory. We know what happened afterwards, but the tension is to understand what happened at the very beginning. Because if I know what happened at the very beginning, not only increase my knowledge, but I may be able to impact the process. And with the current technology, we start to understand a little bit more about the situation. That's why I keep saying earlier onset Parkinson's disease, young onset Parkinson's disease, it is way different than later onset Parkinson's disease.
Okay, so if we do look at much earlier onset, and you said there can be a few different things at play, it could be an infection, it could be environmental, it could be all of these different things. How does that impact treatment?
Absolutely. Excellent. So it impacts for a reason. The gold standard treatment of Parkinson's disease, as we all know, is to supplement dopamine with levodopa or with dopamine agonist. We know that. Unfortunately, we don't have new treatment for that, something that can help restore the cells, something that can help the dopamine to be reproduced. We don't have that yet, at least. But a treatment can be highly impacted because our knowledge on dopamine is a knowledge based on older individuals, not on younger individuals. Means what we know, the time to dyskinesia, time to fluctuations and response to the medication, even the response to the medication, even the absorption of the medication is based upon what we have been knowing for decades on later onset patients. Earlier onset patients are totally different. I have patients that do not respond well to the oral agents. I had to use a different kind of agents. I have patients that do not respond well to the regular cinnamate, carbidopa-levodopa. I had to use different formulations. I have patients where I'm not able, despite I know there's a problem, to easily replenish the dopaminergic loss. Why? Because the disease is systemic. So it's affecting the absorption. It's affecting the way they respond to the drug. And if they have coexistent problems, such as, for example, metabolic problems affecting some enzymes that are responsible for motility or for movements of the bowels or for whatever, we are not going to have the same kind of response. So knowing these underlying causes, these concomitant causes, can guide me, counseling what to do, preventing problems, and if I do, for example, a genetic test and I see that people have specific genetic mutations, I know how they will respond to the medication. So knowing that there's a difference between earlier and late, and within early onset, having a number of subtypes that we are still struggling to identify. But we all know there's a subtypes. People that are in this field know. People that are listening to us, for sure, they don't look alike. They have different background. They have different symptoms. They have different way that the disease is affecting them. We still have the same disease just because this is the name we call it. But ultimately, it's just a, a reduction. The common theme is reduction of dopamine in the brain. That's what it is. Personally, mm-hmm. I think we're talking about young versus early. I think we should call the disease in a different name completely, if we could.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well,
drop Parkinson's disease and talk about something else.
Something else. Because that brings up this, idea that, later onset, there's, you get a clinical diagnosis, you have two out of the three of sort of the cardinal symptoms. Often those symptoms are not showing up for younger onset. And so is how do you diagnose somebody who is really doesn't present like what we think of as somebody with Parkinson's? And what is the sort of clinical bright line that says you have Parkinson's or you have young onset, early onset Parkinson's?
So unfortunately, I have to repeat myself in a sense that the clinical criteria that we use are the one used, as you say, later in life. And as you say very well, they do not necessarily are present the same way they are in early onset Parkinson, on a young onset Parkinson. They're not. Mm-hmm. And people present in a very different way to the point that sometimes, and there's some studies that are showing up. We don't have yet this data. I cannot say very much about it because we haven't yet published this data. But there is a huge, massive delay from onset to diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people will get diagnosed with like a orthopedic issue, right?
One of the most common presentations is the presence of dystonia, for example. Mm. Inverted dystonia after a marathon, people are thinking they have a muscle sprain and they go to the orthopedic surgeon. But it's very difficult to make this diagnosis. Very difficult. We unfortunately need to yet use the famous cardinal signs. But together with the cardinal signs, I think it's imperative for experts on the field to look beyond and start to use DAT scan, PET scan, MRI, other diagnostic tests, lab works, genetic tests that can confirm what we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And especially in early onset Parkinson, is young onset Parkinson, we need to make this extra effort to confirm what's going on. Mm-hmm. Because
so for, does a DAT scan always, you know, in somebody young? And so what can you, for the people who don't know, what is a DAT scan checking? Well, and then what if it, if the DAT scan doesn't say anything, what, where do you go? What do you do?
The DAT scan is a particular test that is ordered by your physician that is talking and showing the activity of some specific nuclei of the brain called basal ganglia. And this particular test, it should give you two sets of answers, yes, no. So either you're positive or you're not positive. Unfortunately, it's still based on visual representation. So it's the radiologist that review and say you're positive or you're not. Many times I see negative results that actually are indeed positive or vice versa.
And that's because of training on the
part of
the reader? Okay.
Because of training, and also we have now some abilities, for example, at Mayo and in many other centers where we can quantify the actual loss. So getting a more objective measure of the loss of the activity. The test is quite specific and sensitive, but it's not telling the full story. Because if it's positive, it's telling us one thing, what I told you before. The dopaminergic activities are lower. But if it's negative, it's not telling you that you don't have Parkinson. Yeah, it's more likely that you don't. But it shows only one piece of the equation, not the full piece. So it cannot be the only test that people are coming after, say, I have a suspicion of Parkinson. Let me do the last scan. It's negative. You don't have Parkinson. It's not likely, but I cannot yet exclude it. In Italy, where I'm from, we use this technique ever since the late 90s. It's been around for a long time. And I remember when I was a young doctor, people were coming to me with a piece of paper without saying a word, with a DAT scan result, and say, doctor, what do I have? Do I have Parkinson or not? That's not the way you have to make a diagnosis. You cannot base upon one test only. What this test should be part of a bigger effort involving multiple aspects to try to understand what's going on.
Okay, so one of the things you talked about was response to medication, and sometimes, you know, young onset, they don't respond to normal levodopa interventions. And this is interesting because for a long time, I want to get into deep brain stimulation and why it can be beneficial for young people. But at the same time, you know, the argument was always, well, if you respond to levodopa, you're going to respond to DBS. And that's not necessarily the case because, so this is confusing.
So, 100% confusing is a dynamic and constant changing word. But it's true. In the past, when I started to train, they were saying, oh, you can get, if you had to do deep brain stimulation, you can get the same response that carbidopa levodopa does it. So it's crucial that you have a good response. And it's still valid if you have a good response, even if it's fluctuating response to carbidopa levodopa. You know, the likelihood that a deep brain stimulation works if done properly is higher. But it's also true that some people cannot tolerate carbidopa levodopa. Not necessarily they don't respond, they simply cannot tolerate it. Or they don't respond, or whatever, they cannot use the drug. In these circumstances, deep brain stimulation can be a very good alternative, as well as duopa pump. Let's not forget about the pump. The pump is saving some problems with absorption in the small intestine, getting a faster constant absorption. So those are two things that we should consider, not only deep brain stimulation. But I'm saying, deep brain stimulation can be a good alternative, even in absence of levodopa response. But telling the patients, hey, we are not sure. I have patients that, despite my best attempts, they didn't respond to anything. My next step is that, okay, you're getting worse. I need to be doing something. We need to be doing deep brain stimulation. Knowing that maybe the response is not optimal, but is one of the last, one of the few things I have in that circumstance. The question you had to ask, say, why you didn't respond? Why? We don't know. There are some people that have some genetic makeup some environmental problem, some disease that is different, still causing a damage in the basal ganglia, but it's different, that does not have the same rate of response or responding at all to carbidopa, levodopa. And not because you had not because you have complications of or immediate dystonia or dyskinesia, so abnormal movement. Simply there's no response. And it's a problem. But let me say something about deep brain stimulation. We have to be very careful there. There's some data that are surfacing that do not necessarily warrant the use of deep brain stimulation early on, even in early onset Parkinson, unless it's really needed. So what I don't want, and I want people to think, okay, I am destined to do deep brain stimulation, is not true. I'm doomed to do deep brain stimulation, is not true. And I will need deep brain stimulation for sure, is not true. It's something that can be used as a tool in some selected cases. And especially I would say in early onset individual, young onset people, we have to be extra careful, even extra careful.
Do you think it's gotten to the point where it's being used too much?
No, not necessarily, but I'm worried that we're gonna go there and it's not gonna be good because we have some data that support that is not always great to be doing. This data has been presented to the Neurological Society by my group showing that surprisingly, people that ever with early onset Parkinson's disease, young onset Parkinson, F550 and below, that underwent deep brain stimulation had an increased slight increased risk of having cognitive decline, which I don't like the idea. And I wasn't expecting that. I'm not here to say, to hide the data. To me, the data need to be out there because they have to be saying, okay, we had to be careful. It means that we can do it, but we had to be careful. It's not something that we can jump to conclusion very easy because it's still a procedure and it's not, there's a lot of moving pieces. And again, we are, as usual, adopting technology tested in older individuals, in younger individuals, which is not exactly what we would like to do, but is the way it works.
Right. Okay. So can we talk a little bit about how progression looks for both different groups?
That's one of the most difficult questions because if the groups are different, I mean, if we do to macro groups later onset, early onset, I can give you some solid data.
Yeah. That one. Let's do that one. So
later onset, the data that we have, survival, so in other words, time to death after the diagnosis, is generally speaking about 12 to 14 years after the diagnosis. So if somebody is diagnosed with Parkinson's disease at 75, he or she will look about 90, 92, which is not bad. You're getting old anyway. And the causes of deaths are the usual one for the Western world. So cardiovascular diseases, cancer, pneumonia, so those are stuff. In early onset Parkinson's, it's totally different. From diagnosis to death, to last encounter is 48 years.
That's amazing.
So this is that, and I'm giving you generally speaking numbers that encompass a full array of different individuals, clearly. So there's people that may be having a shorter duration, people that have a longer duration, but so there are exceptions to the rules. We're talking about large numbers here. But this is an attestation to show the major biological difference between the two conditions.
Yeah.
So 48 years. And I tell you, I always tell my patients, if they come to see me, they know that if you're a woman and you have tremor, that's the best you can be.
Being a woman, you know that you're later onset because you have that. Is that why? Because they're
whether you're late or whether you're young. Being a woman and having tremor is great. The prognosis is much better. And a woman makes sense. I mean, and not to do with estrogens. I wish it was with estrogen. Well, women, generally speaking, they've been exposed to a higher level of estrogens throughout their life. Clearly, no. Men is on the opposite, they have a testosterone. If you ask me, we have very little information about the role of testosterone in the degeneration of any sort of degenerative diseases. We are trying to fill this gap as well, but it's not going to be easy. But what makes a difference there is one little gene that is very important. Chromosome X. Chromosome X is crucial for our life. There's no life without at least one chromosome X. You have condition with X and zero, Turner syndrome, but you don't have condition with Y and zero. They're still birth. So chromosome X is the most important, single most important chromosome that we have. It's one that is not necessarily studied formally, even with the whole genome sequences. Studying the full genome is not always studied because it's very difficult to study. There's all the redundancy. It's a nightmare for our colleague in genetics. They hate the chromosome X to be studied. It's super difficult to explore. But that is single-handedly the most important good prognostic factor for Parkinson's disease, being a woman. And again, I don't talk about gender here. I'm talking about chromosomes.
Yes.
X and Y. That's what it is.
That's interesting. Okay, so let's talk about women for a minute.
Sure.
It seems that so many of the biological processes that women experience, menstruation, pregnancy, breastfeeding, menopause, hormone fluctuation, all of those things, that the distinction between YOPD and later onset in women is probably even more important, right? So what are some of the biggest differences you see for your early onset women versus later onset women? And is there you seeing a big difference between postmenopausal and regardless of age, right? Like later menopause, early menopause, that kind of thing.
Let me tell you first one sore spot is that women has been absolutely underrepresented in scientific literature. Early onset women as well with Parkinson has been very much not represented, not necessarily studied. There's a number of studies that shows that women are having a delay, a further delay in getting to a specialist compared to men for Parkinson's disease in North America. So we're not talking about the countries that are developed. I'm talking about North America there, you know, the most important country, quote-unquote, for in this moment in the Western world. But clearly, there's a lot of needs and a lot of things that needs to be done, because I tell you something shocking. Women and men are different, okay? Women and men are very different. And the disease, and I don't talk about social rights here. No. They're biologically different. Mm-hmm. And even the diseases are looking different, because I give you a practical, very simple example. We're talking about estrogens, okay? Women need more levodopa compared to men to have the same effect. And these increase the risk of dyskinesia in women compared to men. Why? Because the circulating estrogens that women have more are displacing the amount of levodopa in the blood. So they need more. And this changes as we get older. That is why, and many women can tell you that, with early onset Parkinson, during their menstruation, during the menstrual period, things can get definitely worse.
Mm-hmm. It's like their medications don't work at all.
Perfect. And then better, and then worse again. Mm-hmm. And then maybe after menopause, and menopause is, again, a moving target, we cannot tell you, talk about when it's going to be early, or menopause is difficult to say. But after the say, let's say after the age of 45, where many people start to enter, at least in some biological changes, things level up a little. But to the point, they're not. Another thing I want to mention, women are different, pregnancy and Parkinson. A complete abandoned field that now we are trying to fill the gap with some colleague in the Netherlands doing a PD registry for women that have in pregnancy. And actually I want to mention his name, Dr. Osterban. She's a gynecologist from the Netherlands. She had Parkinson's disease. She has Parkinson's disease. And she had two pregnancies without Parkinson and third pregnancy with Parkinson. So not only she's a physician, she has a patient, but she's firsthand experienced that. And we always been very careful, but this is another topic that has been abandoned and has been neglected in the literature. And we need to do that. We need to study more. Another thing seems to be silly. Still about women, veteran women, women that are in the army. There's not very many data about early onset Parkinson in the army, and I'm pretty sure that's something that we need to be looking into that, but I'm pretty sure there are even less for women, and we need to fill these gaps. So there's a number of gaps, but from a standpoint of seeing patients every day and doing research on the topic, there's massive difference between men and women in terms of response to medication, because women require more. In terms of role of estrogens, I always ask for menopause. I always make sure that people are not taking estrogen. Sometimes they're taking estrogen. Say, take progesterone instead. And I try to involve whenever I can, and whenever there's something, let me pass the term, fishy, I'm always involving somebody in the women health clinic, because we need to be understanding that. But another thing I say about women that is very important, autoimmune diseases. Women are definitely more prone to have autoimmunity compared to men. And that is to be the fact that women are able biologically to grow a parasite in their body, which is, you know, having a pregnancy. So women tendentially have the tendency to be more an autoimmune disease compared to men. And this is an important role of neuroinflammation in development of early onset Parkinson or Parkinson in general. And men do not have this issue.
So are you saying there's a link between people who get autoimmune early and then develop Parkinson's, or it's so common for them to have?
Not necessarily that linear, but clearly there are some types of Parkinson disease that have been ignited by an inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
And it means started, or at least manifested earlier, because there is an immune response. And this means that clearly immune response has a role in the development of the disease. And there's a difference between men and women there. 100% there's a difference.
Wow. Okay, let's chat a little bit about
another thing to say about women and Parkinson, another neglected topic, sexuality. It's being completely neglected. Men is easy, quote, quote. I'm a man. Men is easy. You ask your patient, hey, do you have erectile function? That is easy. That is not a difficult question to ask. And sometimes you see Viagra or Cialis in the medication list, so you already know the answer. But how many physicians are asking the same to women? Are asking, hey, I'm not talking about erectile function. It wouldn't be working in women. But what is the correspondence of erectile dysfunction? It's dryness. Vaginal dryness, pain during intercourse. How many people are asking that? Not very many. And that's an important thing to do. But this comes to a question, a topic I want to talk to you at the end, is about education, educating the new generation of physicians, of colleagues, and so forth. That will be something we're going to talk maybe later.
Yeah. Oh, there's so much to consider, right? Yeah. Okay, let's talk a little bit about exercise.
Sure.
Such an important topic. And I want to get your sense on the value of it. Is it the same for people with young onset as it is late onset? What have you found?
And
do you give the people the same recommendation no matter what age they've been diagnosed?
So, yes, everybody should move, okay? Because if you reduce the risk of having cardiovascular diseases, strokes, hypercholesterolemia, and everything else, clearly your brain would have a better well-being and you will live longer. That's a fact, any age. But in early onset, it's even more important. More important. Why? Because it's possible that some of the major changes are indeed mitochondrial, are working on a mitochondria, and we need to activate these little organelles somehow. And exercise is one of the ways that we activate the organelles. I always say, especially in patients or to patients that are young and are on top of their life, I said, okay, do you like to do boxing? Do you like to do rock steady boxing, which is great? Just do regular boxing. just do regular exercise. You have to compare yourself with people your age. Because clearly, if you're 42, and it's not fair for you to compare with somebody who's 72, to start with, it's not fair. Because there's aging there, and you are not aged yet. You will, because we all gonna be, but you're not aged well. So it's good to make sure that you compare yourself with somebody your age rather than somebody with a disease affecting you later in life. But all my patients, I say to engage in exercise and sometimes to tailor the medication intake according to the requirement of their exercise.
Can you make some examples?
Sure. If somebody is training for a marathon, the requirement of dopamine, it should be higher during the marathon. So I always say to my patient, let's try to find a threshold that works for you daily. Imagine like insulin, right? People are having their diabetes. They're taking insulin in a baseline level. That is that one. I don't know, 100 units. Let's make it easy. But there are moments of the day, maybe because you're working out, maybe because you're busy, that your requirements are higher. So the sensor are telling to the diabetes patient, hey, you need to take more because your insulin is, maybe you need to take extra 50 units and so forth. Same story with Parkinson's. Somebody's taking, let's say, one tablet of dopamine, doesn't matter what, three times per day. Maybe the particular day that they're training for the marathon, they need 1.5. Maybe 4 times per day, maybe an extra dose in between the intervals. And then on the weekend, when maybe they're not working out or they're chilling out with their family, they need less than one. So the amount of medication can change according to the needs, and exercise sometimes makes you require more.
Mm-hmm.
And people need to be taking more. I don't want people to grind through that because my biggest concern is falling. If somebody falls and breaks bones, it's not good.
Mm-hmm.
And so the biggest concern is making sure people are not falling. Because if they do, we have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the trajectory is going to be different then.
Yeah. So somebody actually told me, they wrote in and said that a lot of people will tell them, hey, you have to have your medication same time every day and, you know, no matter what. And she says, I don't listen to that. I just take it when I need to take it. And she said, you know, I can see where for some people it needs to be more regimented because, you know, they're going to do it. But what is your opinion on people taking this into their own hands and saying like, well, I'm just going to take it when I think I need it?
First of all, nobody knows their body better than yourself, right? Your own, what your body requires and what body needs. So I don't feel what neither you do, but nobody feels what a patient feels. So they know better than anybody else. So I tend to listen what they tell me, number one. Number two, that is an important thing. There's truth in both. Clearly, that's why I told you before, a threshold is good to know. It's good to know if levodopa works for 6 hours and then you need it again. So clearly you need to be taking every 6 hours because otherwise there's a drop that is too substantial at times, or 5 hours and so forth. But it's also truth that some people, again, within young onset Parkinson, there are different subtypes, some people do not have this massive wearing off or not having wearing off at all, but they still require the medication. So this patient, I agree with this patient. I don't feel the need of taking the meds. I need it only when I know. I feel that I'm fine with that. But he or she start to have declines wearing off, then you have to do both. A little bit of a regimented, stable, same time every day, more or less, plus some extra that people may need in some specific circumstances.
Okay, great. We are almost out of time, but I have to ask you this question. No. Hopefully we can cover it, just a general coverage of it. Dementia and uh-huh. cognitive decline, young onset versus late onset.
Sure. So let's start to define dementia. Dementia is a memory decline that clinically defined as memory decline that patients may or may not realize they have, but family members, they do realize they have, that has a significant interference in the activity of daily living. So in other words, when somebody is demented, he or she is not able to function independently. That's the clinical definition. As we get older, let's talk about late onset Parkinson's. As we get older, after the age of 75 years of age, 40% of all of us human beings are accumulating plaques and tangles in the brain that are the same plaques and tangles that you see in Alzheimer's disease. So as a function of aging. And it's true that the data on Parkinson's disease later phase are pointing that about 35-40% of patients may have some sort of memory problem, from very mild to very severe. But the memory problem that people with Parkinson they have is not the same memory problem that people with dementia or Alzheimer's disease they have. It has to do with dopaminergic loss, is affecting other circuits on the brain, usually the executive function, the planning function, what we call the visual spatial ability, so the ability to know where your body is in the context of space, and the ability to, as I mentioned before, executive, do a plan, a multitask plan, is going to be tough. Clearly, also memory per se, short-term memory can be affected. Early onset Parkinson is totally different because there's no aging, as far as we can tell. So the plaques and tangles are not there. And it's true. Depending on what part of the circuit is involved, we may have different form of memory disorder. And one thing I said in the past, I say it again, the first treatment is to optimize carbidopa, levodopa, dopamine. Because sometimes memory decline is because the medication is dropping. So increasing the medication will potentially provide some massive benefits. So I do not treat memory disorder in late or early if I'm not at first optimizing the medication, number one, because that is a problem. Number two, memory disorder in the young, the most common complaint I receive is, I have brain fog. I have problems at times during the day. I struggle. I feel like I'm in a cloud. And this can be, again, a function of fluctuation of the medication, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes it has to do with the different circuits that are involved, the different frontal circuits that are involved in earlier onset Parkinson's disease. Because if you ask me about the frequency of dementia, of clinically defined dementia in early onset Parkinson's disease, is not very common. It's not very common, the clinical defined. So if I do a formal test, I look at the biomarkers and I have a diagnosis of dementia, it's not very common. But the complaints of brain fog, memory disorder are very high. And they can interfere substantially with employment, with work, with social life, because it's almost being fatigued all the time. I mean, this burden, this is at least what my patient told me, and I tend to listen to them. So that's what they told me, a burden on top of their head. That's the most difficult one. And sometimes it's not easy to treat, but I think it's worth doing it, it's worth treating it. Again, some of my colleagues don't even know about that, and it's a problem, because those are concerns that are raised by the patient. Typically, the neurologist will do the maneuver, see the tremor, and say, oh, you're doing good. But that is the tip of the iceberg. There are so many more things that if not asked, or if they're not reported by the patients, are having massive role. And I don't know what my patient in front of me, what is the main problem of my patient. They had to let me know, but they had to ask. Because if I don't ask, for sure, the tremor is under good control. Fantastic. But that's not the problem. there's way more. And memory decline, brain fog, memory issues seem to be one of the big ones. In spite of normality, quote, quote, normal results for dementia. Because remember, we talked about it before, the Lewy bodies are not necessarily there. And if they are there, they can be a common outcome coming from different sources, but it's not necessarily the main drive of the symptoms that we see in earlier, younger patients.
Okay. Oh, gosh. I have so many more questions. Hopefully we can do it again. We can do it again. Is there anything that you're really excited about in the research or work that you're doing that you want to tell us about before we say goodbye?
Yeah, sure. No, absolutely. So the initiatives are very many, very, very many. What I'm excited about is that there's a couple of potential targets, medication target, to try to help a specific subtype of Parkinson's disease. We're working with a number of, some biomarker, blood biomarkers, that can be also target for potential medications that are already available in the market. They should be repurposed to something different. So that would be something quite interesting. There's maybe a couple of trials coming out, but my problem with the trials is that there's not very many trials, and I'm trying to be diplomatic here, there's not very many trials only on early onset Parkinson. There's not. Mm-hmm. And he's wrong, but he's also wrong to lump early onset Parkinson together. We had to divide. We had to differentiate. So one of the things I'm excited about, my team is trying to understand the different, what we call phenotype, the different type of disease, to see how we can potentially customize the treatment for different people. That would be another thing. What I'm excited, I hope that there will be some research grant calls from NIH, from Michael J. Fox, from maybe you guys, from anybody, doesn't matter who, that will be devoted, this is my wish, devoted only on early onset Parkinson's. That is, to me, the biggest weak link that we have in this moment, because all the current research is not necessarily devoted to early onset Parkinson, but to Parkinson in general, which is okay. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it's not right. But we have spent an hour, and everybody here in this call knows that what we talk here is completely different. And this means that the approaches that have been used so far, and I'm not saying anything that we don't know, they have not necessarily led to advanced science. So I hope that my wish would be indeed, and this would excite me, if we will have one day at one point something specifically for early onset Parkinson's.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I hope it comes. I hope the day comes sooner rather than later. Thank you so much for being here. I'm so grateful, and I can't wait to share it with everybody.